Hello everyone, John Sounds speaking. Welcome to the edition of the Chester and Flint Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, 22nd of May. I hope everyone is in good health and spirits. The weather can't make up its mind, but we've had quite bright and pleasant days recently. It's certainly growing weather. My lawns are being mown at the moment, usually by my son, not by me, and the weeds are shooting up on my patio as I haven't been able to attack them. The reason for that is birds. Years ago, I knocked up a box for the great tits, which seemed to abound in the neighbourhood. It has served well, being occupied most years, including this year. Attached to the house wall, it overlooks the patio, where some big weeds are growing. As I don't want to scare or interrupt the nesting birds, I daren't burn away the weeds, which are flourishing. It'll just have to wait, I suppose, and I'll study the birds' behaviour, which is interesting. I have on the patio a large umbrella-type laundry area, about 10 feet from the nesting box. Usually the great tits, returning from finding food for their young, perch on it and check forwards, backwards and sideways, as if they realise I'm watching them. They sometimes take minutes to be reassured, but now and again they forget and hurtle down from the trees straight into the box, just bypassing the bird that is wavering in doubt. I would have thought that they would trust me by now, as I really try to keep out of their way and not bother them. I'm happy to see them, but I'll be glad when they've raised their brood and departed. Watching them takes up too much of my time, and jobs are not getting done. Somehow, over the years, I've never really seen much of the newly hatched birds. I think they leave the nest before I get up in the morning. I wouldn't expect them to wait. I even wonder if the present nesting pair have themselves been hatched in my little box. Could be. Feeling that I know so little of the hatching process of the great tits, I checked on the computer and came across a video taken in a little nest box like mine. It gave me a total shock. The box was crammed with five youngsters plus parent. All movement seemed chaotic and forceful and never stopped. The only sign of order came when another parent arrived with food in its bill, and five wide-open beaks shot out, craving frantically. I was amazed that very young birds could survive in such chaotic conditions. Perhaps some don't, though I've never seen a dead bird when cleaning out the box after their departure. Only occasionally have I seen a young bird with its parent. It seems that some youngsters still beg for food for a short while by flapping their wings at the adult, and then they are gone for another year. I hope they remain lively and safe and keep away from the magpies. Now, what's been going on locally? Now for the news with extracts from the local papers. Sunrise in Chester on Sunday, May 24th is 4:59 a.m. and sunset 9:17 p.m. And now, over to the readers.
Hello, it's Helen Holyoake here. A man who made a living nightmare for his neighbours has been locked up. Mark Dixie of Nant Peris in Blaken appeared in Carnarvon Crown Court for sentence on Friday. The 51-year-old had previously admitted two offences of harassment without violence, which took place in Shotton over a number of dates last year. Elin Owen, prosecuting, told the court that the offending took place while Dixie was the subject of a community protection notice. He had come to the attention of police due to numerous reports from various neighbours about his behaviour between January and May. The victim of the first offence, David Vickers Tews, reported numerous issues with the defendant. They included Dixie throwing a light bulb at his vehicle, making obscene gestures towards his CCTV cameras, and shockingly, making a false and malicious 999 call, alleging that an incident with a knife had occurred. That call resulted in armed police attending Mr. Vickers Tews's home. In his victim statement, Mr. Vickers Tews said the defendant had made his life a living nightmare. "It's horrific," he said. "I feel massively intimidated by Dixie." The second victim, Elizabeth Jones, was shouted at by the defendant, as well as receiving obscene gestures from him. In her statement, Ms. Jones said, "Dixie's behaviour had caused her persistent fear and sleep deprivation, as well as affecting her work and relationships." Ms. Owen told the court Dixie's offending put him in breach of a suspended sentence, which he had admitted at the outset of the hearing. Matthew Dunford, defending, said, "He's a man who's not in good health. The pre-sentence report refers to learning difficulties Mr. Dixie has and his isolation, which appears to be a catalyst for his behaviour. I've been assisted by his probation officer, who tells me he has completed one half of the suspended sentence rehabilitation days, 15 of the 30 ordered. The information is that he is, apart from these offences, complying with the terms of the order. I ask the court to have regard to that." Judge Nicola Jones opted to activate 10 months of the breach's suspended sentence and imposed 4-month jail term for the harassment, making a total immediate custodial period of 14 months. A 10-year restraining order was made in order to protect the victims.
Hello, this is Diane Frith. Inquests into deaths of babies murdered by Lucy Letby are delayed until 2027. This comes after it was announced that Lady Justice Thirlwall's inquiry report will not be published until at least September. Excuse me. Inquests into the deaths of six babies whom Lucy Letby was convicted of murdering have been delayed until next year. The infants died at the Countess Hospital in 2015 and 2016 when Letby was employed as a nurse in the neonatal unit. Full hearings into their deaths were scheduled for September after each inquest was previously opened and suspended. However, the hearings have been relisted to provisionally begin on May 10th, 2027, after it was announced that Lady Justice Thirlwall's inquiry report into how the nurse was able to commit her crimes will not be published until at least this September. A statement on the Thirlwall inquiry website said, "The inquiry can now give a further update regarding publication of the final report. The report will be published at the earliest practical date. However, that will not begin until after the summer recess of Parliament. We will give further updates regarding publication in due course." On Wednesday, the suspensions of the inquests of Baby C, Baby D, Baby E, Baby I, Baby O and Baby P were formally continued at Cheshire Coroner's Court. A statement issued on behalf of the court said, "The coroner considers it appropriate to maintain the suspension in order to ensure that the findings and recommendations of the Thirlwall inquiry can be fully considered before the inquests proceed. The matter will be further reviewed in November," added the statement. Letby, 36, from Hereford, is serving 15 whole life orders after she was convicted at Manchester Crown Court of murdering seven infants and attempting to murder seven others between June 2015 and June 2016.
Hello, Esther Newt here. A Chester bathing spot at Sandy Lane and the River Dee is now open. The official bathing season begins on Friday and will run until September the 30th. The season will see 464 sites open across England's coasts, rivers, and lakes, subject to regular water quality testing. Community group Clean Dee campaign welcomed the new spot after years of working with sporting and environmental groups. Diane Parrish and Emma Sharp of the Clean Dee campaign said, "At a time when improving water quality across our rivers, lakes, and seas remains a major priority, receiving bathing water status marks an important milestone. This stretch of water is already enjoyed by many local people, and we hope the new bathing water designation will encourage even more residents and visitors to take part in leisure and sporting activities, as well as supporting the health of the river." Samantha Dixon, Chester North and Neston MP, has prioritised improving the health of the River Dee and Dee Estuary since her election and welcomed the designation. "This is fantastic news," she said. "The River Dee is one of our greatest natural treasures, supporting wildlife, recreation, and well-being. Bathing water designation is a major leap forward. It means regular water testing, transparency, and the power to tackle pollution head-on." The Clean Dee campaign and our local river users have shown what community determination can achieve. And I'd like to extend my heartfelt thanks for all their work on this fantastic achievement. I've seen this spirit at our Dee summits, where residents, environmental groups, and stakeholders come together to drive real change. Bathing water designation is a major leap forward. It means regular water testing, transparency, and the power to tackle pollution head on.
Hello everyone, Margaret Bellis here. Work to partially demolish the former Mecca Bingo site in Chester is underway as part of a project to create a new hotel and office building. The rear of the former bingo hall, which has been closed since 2023, is in the process of being broken down and removed by demolition teams stationed at Union Terrace. Cranes have already begun to dismantle parts of the building's roof and remove large parts of the brickwork. Plans were approved in July 2024 to build a major new hotel and office space developed by TAG. An amendment in February 2025 was made to allow for a minimum of 5% accessible room allocations for guests with mobility issues or disabilities. These included a more circulation space for vehicles at the front of the site and brought the total number of rooms to 146. The distinctive black and white facade of the former Mecca Bingo, which was carried over from the original Gorman Place Cinema, built in 1931, will be retained as part of the building office area.
Hello, I'm Patrick Blunden. Cheshire Police have launched a summer safety campaign in Chester targeting drugs, disorderly behaviour, and violence against women and girls. The campaign, called Keeping Chester Safe, With You, For You, was launched on Tuesday, 19th of May, ahead of the Chester race season and the city's busiest summer weekends. Officers will work alongside pubs, bars, door staff, and licensing officers across the city centre, with resource packs being distributed to licensed premises. Venues will run the Ask for Angela scheme, a discreet code word system that lets anyone feeling unsafe approach staff and be helped to leave or to get assistance.
Inspector James Wilson from Chester's neighbourhood policing team said Chester is a safe city to visit and has a vibrant and popular nighttime economy, particularly at weekends, during race days, and across the summer months. From venue queues and transport routes to fast food outlets and pubs, officers are working with door staff, bar teams, and businesses to ensure that those enjoying a night out in Chester are kept safe. Our message is clear. Women and girls should feel safe when attending the city, and police and partners are working together to provide accessible support, including Ask for Angela, discreet materials in licensed premises, and information about how to report concerns or seek help. Drugs will not be tolerated, and we run regular enforcement operations with partners to target these offences. There will also be visible patrols and enforcement action targeting alcohol-fueled disorder and antisocial behaviour. Inspector Wilson said, anyone who feels unsafe or witnesses concerning behaviour can speak to venue staff, approach officers on patrol, or report concerns through normal police channels.
Hello everyone, Sarah Bell here. The Duke and Duchess of Westminster, Hugh and Olivia Grosvenor, joined hundreds of visitors to mark 80 years of Westminster Park at the weekend. The green space in Hough Lane, Chester, enjoyed a celebration on Saturday, May the 9th, that drew hundreds of people, many of them visiting for the first time. The guests of honour attended the free afternoon event, which showcased the range of sports clubs and community organisations that use the park. Made possible through funding from the Duke of Westminster, the event marked 8 decades since the Grosvenor family gifted a 999-year lease of the land to the community as a public park for sport and recreation. The Duke and Duchess began their visit by unveiling plaques for 2 commemorative trees planted along the park's nature trails before touring the grounds to meet volunteers and participants from clubs on display, taking in cricket, football, and croquet along the way. In a highlight of the afternoon, the cricket club invited the Duke to join them on the pitch and face a few balls, an invitation he duly accepted. The pair also unveiled a commemorative board at the park's 9-hole golf course, marking its 50th anniversary, having been opened by the Duke's father. They rounded off the celebratory event by presenting prizes to young people who had excelled in the park's activities, including the most improved junior player at Glenabba Tennis Club. They also viewed a selection of photos as part of Chester's Zoo's Young Environmental Photographer competition. The Lord Mayor of Chester and the Deputy Leader of Cheshire West and Chester Council addressed attendees before the Duke of Westminster spoke of what the park represents to the city and to his family. Walking around today, you can see exactly why Westminster Park matters so much, said the Duke. It is a place to play sport, to meet friends, to bring children, or simply to get some fresh air and clear your head.
Hello, Jan Woodhouse here. 2 businesses in Chester have received closure orders following an investigation into the sale of illegal tobacco and vapes. Local Station Off License in Brook Street and Easy Go Vape in Delamere Street will be required to remain closed until August the 18th, 2026. Cheshire West and Chester Council Trading Standards Team, working in partnership with Cheshire Police and Cheshire Fire and Rescue Service, carried out coordinated inspections at a number of premises across Chester and Neston. The operation, supported by a specialist detection dog, uncovered a significant quantity of illegal products, including 11,040 cigarettes and 2.6 kilograms of tobacco. Closure orders are used where there is evidence of ongoing illegal activity and are designed to prevent further offending, protect residents, and support legitimate businesses. This latest action forms part of the Council's continued efforts to tackle the illegal tobacco market, alongside partners, including the police and the fire service. Illegal tobacco and vape products damage communities in many ways. They are often linked to organised crime and can make it easier for young people to access harmful products and put responsibility on local businesses at a disadvantage. The Council say the operation shows the strength of a partnership approach and that it will continue to take robust action against those involved in illegal trade to protect communities.
A man who was acting suspiciously was found to be in possession of a bladed article in Flintshire, police have said. North Wales Police say they located the man in Holywell during the early hours of Tuesday morning, May the 19th. They added that he has since been arrested and charged following the incident. The arrest comes during a week where North Wales Police and other forces across the UK are carrying out Op Sceptre. The operation is a national anti-knife crime initiative encouraging residents to dispose of unwanted knives safely through designated amnesty bins. The force says knife crime across North Wales remains low compared to other parts of the country, but officers remain committed to proactive prevention. As part of the week-long campaign, North Wales Police are carrying out targeted operations, educational outreach with young people, and working with retailers to ensure knives are not sold irresponsibly. Amnesty bins were made available at police stations, including Wrexham, Mold and Deeside. Sergeant Claire Parry, Community Safety Officer at North Wales Police, said, "Every knife taken off the streets makes our communities safer. Carrying a knife doesn't protect you. It puts you at greater risk of harm. We want people to think twice, make the right choice, and use this week as an opportunity to hand in any unwanted knives or weapons. Together with our partners and communities, we can stop knives from ruining lives." NWP's North Flintshire team said, "Many knives have been handed in to be disposed of safely, primarily kitchen knives. This is an opportunity to hand in any type of unwanted knife in these pop-ups. If you are unable to get to us this week, you can attend one of the council recycling centres or our station in Connors Quay."
Age Cymru is urging older people in Flintshire and across Wales to check what financial support they are entitled to as the charity launches its annual guide for pensioners. The charity said £3 billion of UK state benefits goes unclaimed each year, with more than 100 million of that in unclaimed pension credit in Wales alone. Age Cymru's More Money in Your Pocket guide is split into three sections covering pensions, support relating to the home and well-being. The pension section covers the state pension and pension credit. The home section covers council tax reduction, winter fuel payments and the warm home discount. The well-being section covers carers allowance, attendance allowance and help with NHS costs such as dental treatment, glasses and contact lenses. The charity said some of the support is not means tested, meaning it is available to more people than is typically thought. Age Cymru Chief Executive Victoria Lloyd said, "The cost of living crisis is hitting everyone, but older people in Wales are particularly vulnerable, with 78% of older workers who responded to our survey changing retirement plans due to financial concerns." Ms. Lloyd said, "One of the factors that people are telling us after learning of the support available is that they simply didn't know they were entitled to it." Age Cymru shared a case study of a former HGV driver, identified by the charity only as John, who had never claimed a benefit before because he believed he would not qualify for support. John said, When you have never claimed anything in your life, you don't know what the procedure is. I didn't know whether I would be entitled to anything or not. It turns out I wasn't claiming a number of benefits and entitlements I qualified for. And between my wife and I, we have been missing out on just under £10,000 of support every year, which has made an enormous difference to our everyday lives. He concluded, "I wish I had learned about it sooner, and I'd encourage everyone to read the guide or give Age Cymru a call." The Age Cymru Guide and Benefits Check Tool are available by calling 0300 303-4498. That's 0300 303-4498. And local advice is available from Citizens Advice Flintshire.
Rail passengers at seven Flintshire stations can now tap in and tap out with a contactless card after Transport for Wales launched its pay-as-you-go scheme on Monday, the 18th of May. The Flintshire stations included are Buckley, Caergwrly, Harden, Hardenbridge, Hope, Penyffordd and Shotton High Level. A further eight stations in the Borders area are also covered. These are Bidston, Cefnabedd, Gwersyllt, Heswell, Neston, Upton, Wrexham Central and Wrexham General. Flint and the rest of the North Wales main line between Chester and Holyhead are not included in this phase of the rollout. Transport for Wales has said more stations will be added later this year. The system allows passengers to pay by tapping a contactless bank card or smart device against a reader at the start and end of each journey. The lowest applicable fare for the journey is calculated automatically, removing the need to buy a ticket in advance. Passengers must use the same card or device to tap in and tap out for the correct fare to apply. The scheme builds on a similar service in South East Wales, where Transport for Wales said more than 4.5 million journeys had been made using contactless tap-in, tap-out to date. Alexa Corse, Chief Commercial Officer at Transport for Wales, said, "The launch of contactless pay as you go in North East Wales and Borders is an important milestone in our work to make rail travel simpler, more flexible and better value for our customers. We know that ease and convenience play a vital role in how people choose to travel, particularly for everyday journeys. By expanding contactless tap-in, tap-out travel beyond South East Wales, we are helping more communities travel with confidence and supporting our wider ambition for a better connected and more accessible Wales." Further information on the scheme is available on the Transport for Wales website.
3 years ago, Thomas Ankers was a school leaver who'd just enrolled at Cambria College. Fast forward to 2026, and the 18-year-old apprentice is preparing to represent the UK at WorldSkills Shanghai this September. Thomas, who works for Electro Impact UK Limited in Deeside, will contest the CNC milling category and is one of the only five competitors from Wales to take part in the global competition. His journey to the international stage has been marked by consistent success. In 2024, he was highly commended in the CNC milling at the WorldSkills UK finals before earning a medallion for excellence at EuroSkills Herning 2025 in Denmark last September. Reflecting on his path to Shanghai, Thomas said, "I didn't think the past 3 years would look like this to me, but it is thanks to a lot of people.
Adam Hewins, who started me on this journey and has been my training manager. Electro Impact for supporting me since I joined. Cambria College for providing the workshop I could train in and teaching me so much. And Inspiring Skills Excellence in Wales for backing me as a Welsh competitor. When they told me I'd been selected, I felt incredible. I was so pleased. It's been such a long journey to get here. I fell in love with CNC milling. I love the hands-on aspects, the accuracy and the problem solving. That's really helped me perform in pressure situations because I can completely focus on the task in hand. In competitions, you're given these blind test projects using materials like aluminium, steel and brass, usually with around 6 hours to complete them. We've been asked to create some incredible things, from a Concorde aeroplane to the Hungarian Parliament building, and even Formula One cars. On Team UK's chances in China, he said, we've got a great squad and we're determined to come back with as many medals as we can. I can't wait to get out there and compete against the best in the world.
Police have launched a probe after an off-road biker collided with an officer and a bike was ridden dangerously along the coastal path in Flintshire. North Wales Police North Flintshire team said officers attended Richmond Road in Connors Quay shortly after 8 p.m. on Saturday, May 16th, following multiple reports of off-road bikes and antisocial riding in the area. Police said that during the incident, one black-coloured off-road bike failed to stop for police, collided with a police officer, and was ridden dangerously at speed along the coastal path in an apparent attempt to evade officers. PC Hatton said, "We understand the concern that antisocial riding causes within the community. This type of behaviour will not be tolerated, and we will take robust action against those responsible. I'm appealing for anyone who witnessed the incident or who may have CCTV, dash cam or mobile phone footage to contact us. As we move into the summer months, we would encourage members of the public to continue reporting any incidents of antisocial riding, as this information helps us take action and keep our communities safe."
A Flintshire bookshop is one of 44 independent businesses selected to receive the Penguin Random House Bookshop Grant 2026. In total, more than 150 applications were submitted by independent booksellers seeking support for the delivery of initiatives aimed at igniting and fostering a love of reading amongst young people during the National Year of Reading. The quality and ambition of the applications highlighted the unwavering passion and dedication of booksellers to nurturing and driving children's literacy. Following this exceptional response, 44 independent bookshops have now been selected to receive grants of between £1,500 and £5,000 to see their proposals through to delivery. The grants will fund a wide range of projects, which include courses to increase the verbal reading confidence of parents and guardians, a book gifting scheme aimed at children in care, a young footballers reading club, a scheme empowering pupils to decide which books are in their school libraries, a reading engagement program centered around graphic novels and manga, and the compilation and publication of a collection of translated stories from local families for whom English is an additional language. Applications were assessed based on their innovation, impact and reach, inclusivity and accessibility, clarity of plan, and value for money. The Mould Bookshop, based in the market town, celebrates 45 years in business in October. On finding out about their successful funding application, owner Caroline Johnson said, We are delighted to receive the Penguin Children's Bookshop grant, which will enable us to organise author visits and reading activities for children and parents in small rural schools and communities during the National Year of Reading celebrations. Elspeth Dougal, Head of Sales, Independents and Wholesalers, Penguin Random House UK, said, "Independent bookshops are embedded in their communities, so we knew we would get a great response to the grant. But we've been blown away by the volume of applications and the level of creativity and thought reflected in them. It's a powerful reminder of what these shops are doing every day and their vital contribution to children's literacy and reading for pleasure across the UK."
A resident broke down in tears at Flintshire's planning committee whilst explaining the impact of industrial scale noise from Aldi's refrigeration units near her home. Judith Richards' home is adjacent to the Aldi store at Broughton Shopping Park, which has just submitted a retrospective planning application to replace its ageing refrigeration system. The external refrigerant systems that runs the store's freezers are currently being replaced with eco-friendly carbon dioxide refrigerant units. Those external mechanisms, however, are situated just feet away from the nearest residential homes. Mrs. Richards told Flintshire County Council's planning committee the noise they generate is causing distress for residents. "We are here to consider another retrospective planning application by Aldi after they failed to consult with neighbouring residents or obtaining planning consent prior to starting works to replace refrigeration units," she said. "This is causing distress, disruption and impacts on the quality of life and home environment. Yet despite repeated attempts by neighbours to resolve the matter with Aldi, there's been little meaningful engagement and no resolution." Mrs. Richards then played a recording she had taken of the noise before breaking down in tears. James Borley, the agent representing Aldi, said that the company had engaged with the community over the plans. Aldi has sought to respond positively. Aldi has sought to respond positively and responsibly throughout this process by working with Flintshire County Council officers and neighbours and have proposed additional mitigation where appropriate. He said the new replacement plan proposed will be quieter, more environmentally friendly and more efficient. The predicted noise levels will be 10 decibels below background levels in the day and will not exceed the background noise levels at night. Councillors eventually voted in favour of the proposals, adding a condition that the best effective British standard acoustic fencing is to be installed around the plant to be situated to the south and the western side of the store, and that plans for that fencing would come back to the council for approval before it is installed.
A resident walking through the Stanley housing estate in Ellesmere Port says she encountered a mystery black creature moving through overgrown bushes near the Cheshire Oaks retail park. The sighting this month was reported to wildlife monitoring group Puma Watch, which collects accounts of unusual animal activity across the region. Sharon, who shared the account on behalf of her sister, said the encounter happened at around 9:45 a.m. on 15th of May. Her sister had just dropped her granddaughter at nursery and was walking home through the estate when she noticed the animal. She saw a large but thin panther-like creature going into overgrown bushes, Sharon said. It was black, but she could see leopard-like patterns. It had a typical panther-like gait and a large, noticeable upturned tail. She was too frightened to investigate further. While the witness described the creature as resembling a panther, there is no confirmation of what the animal was, and experts say many reported sightings turn out to be dogs, domestic cats seen at a distance, or other wildlife appearing larger in certain lighting or terrain. Ellesmere Port has nevertheless become a regular location for mystery animal reports. Previous accounts include a close-up sighting in Whitby Park, a large but slender black creature at Ince Marshes, and several reports stretching along the Chester and Wirral corridor. The mix of woodland, marshland, and quiet footpaths around the town provides plenty of cover for wildlife, making misidentifications more likely. Stanley Woods, an ancient oak and silver birch woodland just off the A5117 and close to the Stanley estate, is often mentioned in local discussions about unusual sightings. Its dense undergrowth and limited disturbance makes it a natural corridor for foxes, deer, and other animals that can appear larger when partially obscured. For now, the Ellesmere Port sighting remains unverified, with residents encouraged to report anything unusual so patterns can be better understood.
Chester Zoo keepers have hand-reared a baby aardvark calf, nicknamed Womble, after his mother was unable to produce enough milk to fully support him. The calf was born on the 3rd of April 2026 to Mum Honey and Dad Coos. He is the only aardvark calf to have been born in the UK since 2024. Sophie Tyson, the Chester Zoo keeper who bottle-fed the calf overnight, said, "Onnie's new arrival is only the second aardvark to be born at the zoo in our 94-year history, so it's a very special addition for us all. While we don't yet know whether the calf is male or female, as it is a little too young for us to tell, the nickname Womble has definitely stuck. With the calf's giant ears, long snout and playful personality, we think it's the perfect fit for the time being." Aardvarks spend their days sleeping and are most active at night, so while Mum Onnie heads off to forage for food, we've been giving the calf some extra support to help it grow stronger. For the first few weeks, we placed the youngster in a cosy incubator each evening, and it was bottle-fed warm milk every few hours throughout the night before being carefully reunited back with Mum each morning. Womble has gone from strength to strength and is doing brilliantly, so now lives full-time back with Mum, and it's wonderful to see them snuggling up side by side together. Chester Zoo said there are only 68 aardvarks in European zoos and 114 in zoos worldwide. They are native to sub-Saharan Africa, and the animal's name comes from the Afrikaans for earth pig, and a fully grown aardvark can weigh up to 60 kilograms. In the wild, aardvarks face significant threats from habitat loss caused by agricultural development, which often brings them into conflict with local farmers. They are also hunted for their meat.
At 92 years old, Brian Macklin is still finding new ways to go the distance. The Chester resident has just completed a remarkable 21-mile rowing challenge, the equivalent of crossing the English Channel, to raise much-needed funds for the Hospice of the Good Shepherd, a cause close to his heart. Brian set sail on Monday, May the 11th, at Total Fitness in Chester, quickly drawing in a crowd of staff and fellow gym members who cheered him on. Stroke by stroke, he powered through the miles in five sessions, averaging just under 4 miles an hour, before completing the full distance on the morning of Wednesday, May the 13th. For Brian, fitness has been a lifelong passion. He developed a love of running at just 11 years old when he would sprint through his paper round. His passion for running grew after his service in the RAF, seeing him through decades of running 10Ks and half marathons. At 69, he even ran the London Marathon to support the hospice. For most of my life, I was a long-distance runner and walker, Brian said. I had to stop in my late 80s when I tore my meniscus. But rather than slowing down, Brian adapted. I just thought one day that I wanted to do something for the hospice, he said. I can't run anymore, but maybe I can row. I gave it time to see how I got on with it, and when I realised I was doing well, I thought, yes, I can do this. Rowing has since given him a renewed sense of energy. Before I started rowing, I was struggling to even get on the exercise bike, he explained. Now it's loosened everything up and given me a lot of stamina. But his challenge was about far more than fitness. Brian has supported the Hospice of the Good Shepherd for many years, inspired in part by the experience of a friend's family. My friend's wife suffered with bowel cancer and needed hospice support, he said. It stayed in my mind ever since. I suppose that's what made me think, if I do something, I'll do it for the hospice. Throughout his challenge, Brian wasn't rowing alone. Supporters stopped to chat, cheer him on, and donated as he surged closer towards his goal. People are always keen to support the hospice, he said. Many came up to me while I was rowing because they know what it means. You see, no one knows if or when they might need it. A familiar figure in his community, Brian has also been a long-time supporter of other charities, such as the Air Ambulance and the RNLI, and previously helped establish and lead a local walking club to share his love of fitness and the outdoors with others.
A best-selling author and illustrator has inspired Cheshire pupils to discover the joy of reading and storytelling. Curtis Jobling, best known as the creator of Bob the Builder and the Werewaldser novels, visited schools across Cheshire and Warrington as part of a three-day book launch tour to mark the release of his latest novel, Vampire Empire, Red Tide, published on May the 7th. The tour, organised by Cheshire Education Library Service, ELS, as part of the National Year of Reading celebrations, including stops at schools in Chester, Ellesmere Port, Widnes and beyond. Maria Byrne, Director of Communities and Environment at Cheshire West and Chester Council, said, "This has been an inspirational series of events for all the students involved, and we are really pleased to have been able to work with Curtis to give so many young people the opportunity to meet an author and artist, especially someone who is local but world famous." Mr. Jobling led immersive workshops for pupils in years 6 to 8, combining storytelling, live illustration, and readings from his new book. The tour began at Sandbach High School and included visits to Ellesmere Port Library and Queen's Park High School in Chester, where students from the King's School also took part. Pupils were captivated by Mr. Jobling's stories of Vikings, vampires and vengeful gods, with many taking home signed books featuring original sketches by the author. As a native of Cheshire, Mr. Jobling said returning to his home region made the experience even more meaningful. He said, "As someone who grew up in Cheshire, it's incredibly important to share that creative journey with young people locally." Feedback from the schools has been overwhelmingly positive. Queen's Park High School said, "A lot of children came to the library after school very excited about the events. The next generation of readers are shining through." Whitby High School added, "Our pupils were talking about it all the way back to school." The tour was supported by Nantwich Bookshop, with additional copies of Mr. Jobling's books made available through the ELS and local libraries.
A charity walk has helped raise funds for Clare House Children's Hospice. Organised by Admiral Taverns, the walk is part of an ongoing partnership with Clare House that has so far raised more than £100,000. Chris Jowsey, CEO of Admiral Taverns, said, "It was inspiring to see so many people come together on Saturday, and I couldn't be prouder of everyone involved. The charity walk was a real success, and our total raised for Clare House is now up to £103,198. I would like to say a huge thank you to everyone who has supported us up to this point, from those who walked alongside us to those who donated, cheered us on, or came together with us at the finish. Every contribution has been valued and appreciated. The hospice, which cares for seriously and terminally ill children and their families, relies heavily on community support to deliver its vital services. Lewis Croft, corporate fundraiser at Clare House, said Clare House Children's Hospice is able to continue its work thanks to the generosity of our local community and the backing of fantastic organisations such as Admiral Taverns, so we're thrilled to have them as our charity partner. The event concluded at the Little Oak Pub in Boughton. Adam and Lisa Pickett, licensees at the Little Oak, said it was a real privilege for us at the Little Oak to welcome everyone at this end of the walk and to be part of such a special day.
A family business on the outskirts of Chester, built on a scoop of innovation, is marking 40 years in the trade. Cheshire Farm Ice Cream, founded in Tatton Hall by Margaret and Tom Fell in 1986, began as a way to turn surplus milk into something new after European Economic Community EEC quotas limited how much milk they could sell. The Fells decided to turn this challenge into an opportunity by using the excess milk to create real dairy ice cream. Jonathan Fell, CEO of the ice cream farm, said, "Reaching 40 years is a deeply humbling milestone. When our parents first began making ice cream in a converted shed in 1986, nobody could have predicted it would lead to more than 500,000 visitors a year to our home. Their hard work, determination, and foresight paved the way for us." The business has since grown into two separate but closely related ventures. Cheshire Farm Ice Cream, led by eldest son Graham Fell, and the Ice Cream Farm Visitor Attraction, run by Jonathan. Both are still based on the original land within the Boldsworth estate, with the family farmhouse now serving as their headquarters. Graham Fell, director of Cheshire Farm Ice Cream, said, "Milk is still sourced daily from local Cheshire cows grazing just fields away, and we are fiercely maintaining the 24-hour local milk supply chain that makes our ice cream taste so distinct." Jonathan Fell, who joined the business straight from school in 1987, later led a £5 million redevelopment of the Tatton Hall site in 2015, turning it into the ice cream farm, a destination holding the Guinness World Record for the largest ice cream shop in the world. Cheshire Farm Ice Cream now produces more than 50 flavours and supplies more than 1,000 outlets in the Northwest alone, manufacturing over 10,000 litres of ice cream each day. Meanwhile, Cheshire Farm Ice Cream continues to improve its environmental impact through solar energy and eco-friendly packaging.
A new project led by the University of Chester and funded by the National Lottery through Arts Council England is using virtual reality, VR, to reconstruct the city's historic Roman amphitheatre as part of an experience titled Our City, Our Story, Diva Victrix in VR. Using a combination of immersive technology and archaeological research, the VR experience aims to transport visitors back nearly 2,000 years. Within the digital world, visitors will encounter characters inspired from real people from the past, including a soldier, a trader, a gladiator, and a Romano-British woman, each sharing insights into daily life on the edge of the Roman Empire. The VR experience will be made available to the public during Chester Heritage Festival and the University of Chester's Festival of Ideas. Visitors will be encouraged to share feedback to help shape future versions of the project. Details on dates and locations will be announced. Julian Baum from Take 27 explained that the VR experience will allow users to explore the amphitheatre from the perspective of an audience member in the 3rd century. The VR model is derived precisely from the structurally accurate research model developed by Mr. Baum and Tony Wilmot of Historic England, one of the site's directors of the excavation. Mr. Baum said, "It is now 20 years beyond that excavation, and our understanding of this phase of the iconic structure is now brought to everyone in this immersive VR experience." To learn more about the Chester Heritage Festival, visit www.chesterheritagefestival.co.uk. I'll repeat that, www.chesterheritagefestival.co.uk.
Well, we hope that you find our selection of news items from this week of interest. I'd like to thank our readers, Helen, Diane, Esther, Margaret, Patrick, Sarah and Jan, and also, of course, our technician, Owen, who will be putting the edition together and uploading it later. I'm going to invite our readers now to join me in saying goodbye to end the live part of this edition. Goodbye.
Bye.
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 TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello again, it's Liz from East Kilbride here. Now, if you're listening to this chat, this is perhaps a name that you haven't come across. Eglantine Jebb. And you know, as I go through my life, I know people will say to me, that name just suits that person, maybe a Max, who is a large man. Well, Eglantine is a name that so much suits the temperament of our woman today. Eglantine's name actually means a prickly plant, a sweet briar of a wild rose with lots and lots of needles. So there we have the image of a prickly person, but a beauty of a rose. And I think it suits our Eglantine very, very well. So how to begin? How does the name suit Eglantine? She was born in Shropshire in 1876. A member of a wealthy, comfortably off family, but also a family with a strong social conscience. Now, we're looking at late Victorian times, where although women could not vote and even fully participate in public life, many of them at a local level had found ways of doing their bit, let's put it that way. And Eglantine was surrounded by strong women who had these ideas about the world. Her mother had founded an arts and craft association to give employment in the area. Her sister went on later to help begin the Women's Land Army in World War I. Another sister married a radical Labour MP and was very involved in education for the working classes. She even had a spinster aunt. Spinster, there's another word from an earlier era, who had never married, but had money and determination to learn skills and teach them to Eglantine, who became very proficient in carpentry and in fishing and in all kinds of gardening and, of course, in any kind of financial issues. So this was setting up Eglantine for an active life and a life of, we could call it, service. Her first idea was to go to university. So she did, one of the very first, and read history at Oxford University. But 1 year teaching decided her teaching was not for her. Good for her, making that decision early was probably very wise. And she put her mind to finding out about the society, doing statistics, gathering information, seeing what the reality was in poor areas of survival and more often low survival rates of children, for example. And she wanted to apply these analytical, modern scientific approaches to her charity work. She did lots of background work on education committees, and then, as she was a young, fit and active adult, did what she could in her local area, even leading up to World War I, setting up a boys' employment registry, trying to see what could be done. As the war was approaching, she travelled to the Eastern Front, already a very turbulent area, to try and see what could best support the people of Macedonia who were facing very, very grim times. So she was seeing the reality of conflict, and she was seeing the reality, especially the impact on children. What she did thereafter was to focus her enormous talents on how children were suffering. And at the end of the war wasn't just one day in November 1918. The war, especially for the former German countries and the country which therefore was badly, badly defeated, faced extreme poverty, extreme famine. And it was clear to Eglantine that the Allied blockade following the war was having an appalling impact, especially on the children of the defeated countries. She set up a pressure group called Fight the Famine Council, saying children should not be victims of what adults decided to do. We must protect the children. Now, this was an interesting and even very, very surprising attitude just after the end of the First World War. She was so determined, she had leaflets printed, and she stood in Trafalgar Square and gave out the leaflets saying, "Fight the famine, save the children." She was arrested, and the Crown Prosecutor must have agreed with her decency, and he paid her fine, even after he had fined her. This showed her that ordinary people were more understanding and supportive of the ordinary civilians in Germany and Austria than perhaps the official government line was. And this gave her an inspiration and an idea. In 1919, she set up the embryonic group that became Save the Children Fund. She was immediately surprised and delighted that the British public donated a large sum of money. They knew the children were not to blame. They wanted to support these children in these dire situations. And working with her sister Dorothy, by 1920, the very basics of the Save the Children Union had been established in Geneva. It was always Eglantine's wish to run this as more than a do-good charity. It had to be positive, it had to be scientific, had to make the way the organisation worked most efficiently so that any money gathered could go directly to the children who needed it. And that's when you see Eglantine, perhaps in an echo, sadly, of our present world, she faced one humanitarian crisis after the other. because after the situation in Austria and Hungary began to ease, there was a huge crisis around 1921 in Greece, and that was followed by an even greater emergency, the Russian famine of 1921, which actually affected the old Russian Empire, including the present-day country of Ukraine. Eglantine's organisation shipped hundreds of tons of food and medical supplies during this crisis. And you know, it was clear to her that one crisis after the other needed an organisation that would support children. And also, she wanted to put it very closely and clearly into the world view that children need to have rights. Now, we may think, of course children have rights, but in fact, that was a very new idea, that children should not be victims of adult conflict. And she crafted the Declaration of the Rights of the Child, and it was adopted in 1924 by the organisation, the League of Nations. An organisation which saw the need for this, but sadly, of course, the League of Nations was not able to stop the next great crisis of the World War. Eglantine did not live to see these greater tragedies of the 30s and into World War II. She died really very young, and she died in 1924. And you know, she had struggled against very, very great thyroid illness. One might almost say that she could easily have taken to her bed and just read magazines and not bothered about the world. But that wasn't the making of this woman, and that wasn't the work that she did. And you know, it's amazing how little she is known. Perhaps it's because she died relatively young, or perhaps it's because the organisation was the focus of the world attention and not the person. So that's why she's very much overlooked by history. Because when you look at the work of the Save the Children today, in these days we're living through of extreme trauma and extreme challenge for children, the work is amazing how much she has managed. The Save the Children Fund currently work in over 100 countries, and it's reckoned that their charity, as professional and as dedicated as was always the dream of Eglantine, has saved the lives and enhanced the lives of over 100 million children in 115 countries. Now, if that's not a legacy, I don't know what is. The most vivid, perhaps, legacy of Eglantine Jebb is that we do have a Universal Children's Day. Now, you might not know the day, but you might be aware of their logo. It's a globe of the world and children holding hands around the world. This was the logo adopted by the United Nations, and the 20th of November is Universal Children's Day. It's come a long way in its development from the first dreams and beliefs in social justice for children as dreamed of by Eglantine Jebb, a woman in the shadows, a woman who created and contributed so much. A prickly woman who wanted things done properly, quite usually that was her way, but anyone who worked with her recognised her devotion and her utter dream of bringing better lives to the children of the world. Eglantine Jebb, the founder of the Save the Children Fund. Take care of yourselves, folks. Bye-bye.
TNF Soundings.
A day in the life of actor Gregor Fisher. Gregor Fisher, 72, was born in Clackmannanshire, central Scotland, and attended the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama now the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, in Glasgow. He is best known for playing the string-vested Glaswegian comedy character Rab C. Nesbitt. He has also appeared in films including 1984, The Merchant of Venice and Love Actually. He lives in Ayrshire with his wife, the actress and producer Vicky Burton. They have grown-up children, Alexander, Jamie and Sissy. He says, "As soon as I'm awake, I'm out of bed. I don't mess about. A cup of tea, a bowl of porridge. I am a Scotsman, after all. I used to turn the radio on for the news, but now I shout that thing that we've got, what's it called? Alexa. Turn on Radio 4, Alexa. Sometimes I'm sure it ignores me, so I start getting annoyed like a silly old fool. My wife and my kids tell me I should do a bit more exercise, and they are correct. I've got diabetes and it worries me. John Leckie, the man who brought me up, the man I called father, had diabetes too. He lost his toe, then his foot, then his leg. I didn't want that to happen to me, so I went to see the doctor. She told me it was a question of lifestyle. I said, are you just calling me fat? And she said, well, not fat, but you could lose a wee bit of weight. I lost a few pounds and I feel better for it. Me and the wife lived in France for 12 years, but moved back to Scotland last year. A friend told me about this website where you can put in a few details and it tells you when you're likely to die. Tap, tap, tap. Gregor, you'll keel over at 86. I'd hit my 70s and I realised that whatever time I do have left ought to be spent with my kids, my family, my mates. Good gracious, people will be reading this and thinking, why are they talking to such a miserable soul? Well, wait till I get to the bit about me being orphaned and adopted and orphaned again as a kid. Okay, I'm making a joke about my childhood, but some of it wasn't nice. My birth mother died when I was a baby, so I was adopted by the Fisher family. Then my adoptive mother died after a fire when I was only 4, and I was taken in by Sissy and John Leckie. No, I'm not making this up. Sissy was the real deal and she brought me up. People look at that and they see far more trauma and significance than I ever saw from the inside. That was my normal. I'm not saying it's been easy. Even at 72, there are days when it will jump up and grab me by the throat and the tears will come. When I'm thinking about that stuff, that's when I realise how lucky I have been. My wife and me, that should never have happened. You put us into a dating website and we'd be miles apart. Fate must have had a hand in it. Same with my career. Here I am, still surviving. I'm even on Instagram. My daughter told me that I needed a social media presence, so she filmed me making some tatty scones for lunch, and 500,000 people watched that. Acting is a silly job. People take it so seriously, but it's not like I've discovered penicillin. Some of it has been hugely enjoyable. Working with Al Pacino on The Merchant of Venice and with Richard Burton on 1984. And acting as Rab C. Nesbitt, of course. I'll be honest, I hated that character at first. I didn't get why anybody would be interested in this nutcase. People ask me if Rab is Scottish comedy. Comedy has nothing to do with countries. It's either funny or it's not. Simple as that. If there's a free evening, I'll bash out a few tunes on the piano or water the garden. Those tatties for the scones were grown by my own fair hands. But I've just started touring my one-man show, having a natter about life and what have you. I worry that talking about myself sounds like I'm boasting. I used to talk to my gran about acting and she'd laugh and say, acting? Acting the goat more like. There might be the occasional fish supper, Rab's favourite, but cutting down has helped me with the weight. And good sleep. I'm in bed as early as possible. I've never been what you'd call religious, but I do sometimes lie there wondering what it all means. Come on, there's got to be more than meets the eye, but just don't ask me what it is. This was adapted from an article in the Sunday Times magazine of Sunday, May the 3rd, 2026.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Tina back again here, and I have your answers to this crossword. One across along the top, the past tense of fling is flung. Four across through the middle, information at the beginning gives us intro. And along the bottom is five across, to brush as in the floor, we have sweep. Now the down answers. One down on the left-hand side. Another word for chips. We have fries. Two down through the middle to undo a knot gives us untie. And finally, on the right-hand side, three down, a small number of people, we have group. And that's your crossword. I wonder how you got on.
TNS Soundings.
Broadcaster Michal Hussein talks about her life. Broadcaster Michal Hussein, 53, was born in Northampton, but spent her childhood in the United Arab Emirates. She joined the BBC in 1998 and later became an anchor on BBC World News. She was a presenter on the Today programme on Radio 4 from 2013 to 2024. She is now the host of the Bloomberg podcast, The Michal Hussein Show. She lives in London with her husband and their three sons. She says, I would ask President Trump to what extent he has thought through the Iran war. What were his expectations at the start? What was he advised, and where on earth is all this going? Compared with almost anyone who's done that job before, he is in some ways more accessible. There are lots of examples of journalists managing to get him on the phone and him answering off-the-cuff questions. It's a really interesting attitude to the media. Scathing in some ways, accessible in others. Who wouldn't want to speak to President Trump? Nigel Farage calling me love was an unexpected turn of events. Hussein interviewed him for Bloomberg last October. I don't know whether his reaction was purely annoyance at being pressed on Russia and the accusation that he's soft on national security, or whether he was actually trying to deflect and get into a row about him calling me love. Even when you've reached heights in your career, there will be things you go for that don't work out. That's what I wanted my sons to learn when I didn't get the BBC Sunday morning politics programme, which went to Laura Koonsberg. Because they're about to go into the job market and they will face many rejections. I wanted them to know that that's a part of life and the lesson is not to stop going for things. I used to get up at 3:20 a.m. for the Today programme. I'd leave the house within 20 minutes and cycle to work. But the exacting thing about Today wasn't the hours. The exacting thing was that you have to be at the top of your game and think really hard about the briefs put in front of you. Elon Musk is one of the most consequential people on the planet today. He was on a giant screen looming above me while I sat on stage at Bloomberg events last year. It was a difficult exchange. He's really not used to being pressed. At that point, he had a role in government as well as in business, and I suspect he was finding that combination difficult. Indeed, he left DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, not long after that interview. My family history and who I am today is entwined with the end of the empire in India and decisions made by British politicians. I was amazed when I dug into the Attlee government and the cavalier way that it dealt with the independence and then partition of India. If I were to interview these people today, I'd have a lot of tough questions for them. I was engulfed by a sense of sadness over it. The way that I see the world is probably linked to the experiences of my grandparents' generation, the sense of communities that had existed that were then fractured. Places they were no longer able to visit. My parents gave me a real determination to be the best I could be. Contrary to what people might think of Muslim families, our family was not one where there was any sense that my life opportunities should be any less than my brother's. There have been times in my journalistic life where I've felt guilt. Talking to refugees in the Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh, I had this strong sense that they were going to live there for the rest of their lives. I sat with women who told me about sexual assault. You have the privilege at the end of it of going back to your normal life as a journalist. I've struggled with that. It's impossible not to be moved by these scenes of suffering. As the daughter of immigrants, I have that sense of always wanting to make my parents proud of me, always wanting to be worthy of the sacrifices that they made and their hopes for me. Michal Hussein's book, Broken Threads, My Family from Empire to Independence, is available as an audiobook read by Michelle herself and with a running time of 8 hours and 39 minutes. This was adapted from an article in the Saturday Times magazine of Saturday the 2nd of May 2026.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, it's Tina here, and I have a crossword for you. There are just 6 clues to give us 6 words in a grid of 5 by 5. I'm going to start with the clues for the crosswords. One across, that's along the top. Past tense of fling. 4 across, that's through the middle. Information at the beginning. And 5 across, along the bottom, to brush, as in the floor. Going down now, one down on the left-hand side. Another word for chips, that's the fish and chip variety. 2 down through the middle, to undo a knot. And 3 down on the right-hand side, a small number of people. There you have your clues. We'll give you the answers shortly.
TNF Soundings.
Former Home Secretary and Chancellor Sajid Javid talks about his life. Sir Sajid Javid, 56, grew up in Bristol, one of 5 sons of Pakistani immigrants. After a career in banking, he became Conservative MP for Bromsgrove in 2010. His cabinet roles included Home Secretary and Chancellor, and he was Health Secretary during the pandemic. He left politics in 2024 and he returned to finance. He lives with his wife Laura in London. They have 4 children. He says, "Growing up, I didn't feel poor, but clearly we were poor. My school shoes were the only ones that I had. 7 of us lived in a 2-bedroom flat above my parents' shop. There were drugs and prostitutes on the street when we walked to school in the morning. I didn't know what a prostitute was, but they were very friendly. They'd say, 'Hi, boys, how are you?' That was my home. My mother would take me to the library every Saturday, but she never knew what I was reading because she couldn't read. She'd sit in the corner knitting, and I got really into military books. I'd come home from school and she'd say, 'Do your homework.' And she'd look over and ask, 'Have you got that right?' It might have been maths, but she had no idea how to do it, so I could always say yes. I loved the mod image when I was younger. I was a teenager in Bristol in the early 80s, and I had a Harrington jacket and a parka and long black hair. My mum was always telling me to get my hair cut. I loved the groups Madness, The Specials, UB40, U2 and Wham, and we used to watch Top of the Pops on the TV every week. My comprehensive school was very white, but where I grew up was ethnically diverse. There were Indians, Sikhs, Muslims and Afro-Caribbeans, so I had a real mix of friends. I think it helped to shape me, to understand people of all backgrounds and cultures and the challenges and the opportunities that they face. My careers teacher told me I should become a TV repairman, but I went to the technical college up the road and the economics teacher there transformed my life. It was the first time that any teacher said that I was good at something. He was a Greek immigrant called Charles Stamboulier, and he said to me, 'You'll be Chancellor one day.' I was 17 then, and I just laughed. My parents had already decided, unknown to me, that I was going to have an arranged marriage. It would have been to a cousin. I thought my wife would never go out with me. She's white. But she did. I met her when we were 18 years old and working a summer job in Bristol. It was a real struggle for us. My parents were completely against it and tried for years to tear us apart. They refused to meet her for 5 years. I honestly thought that she was going to leave, and she had every reason to, because of the terrible time she was getting from them. My parents not only came around but said, 'We didn't know what we were doing and we were completely wrong. You were 100% right.' Now, my wife and I have been together 38 years, and I think going through that made us stronger. We are best friends, we share everything, and we make each other laugh. I'm an amateur photographer. I like to photograph nature and urban scenes. Even when I take family pictures, I'm the fussy one, asking everyone to move or to change the light. I give the images to my kids, and sometimes they post them on Instagram. Despite losing my hair, I feel energetic and like I can have a third gig in my life. And also, my wife says that bald men are more beautiful anyway. Sajid Javid's book, The Colour of Home, Growing Up in 1970s Britain, written by Sajid Javid and narrated by Sajid Javid, is now available as an audiobook with a running time of 9 hours and 23 minutes. This was adapted from an article in the Saturday Times magazine of Saturday, the 9th of May, 2026.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I call them Cabin Conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin Conversations about World Music Day. This annual celebration, held on the 21st of June, taps into the universal language of music and widespread appeal in all its forms. World Music Day began with the City event in 1982, originating in Paris, France, known as Fête de la Musique, bringing musicians, street performers, concerts and music lovers together to share this remarkable human talent of expressing emotions and physical skills in a multitude of different ways. Due to the attraction's enormous popularity, the EU made it officially a cultural event. Today, musical venues and historical museums provide public accessible music in around 100 countries. Theories of what constitutes music range from melody with vocal sounds from the Stone Age onwards, through to natural-made instruments using materials like rocks, gourds, animal skins, wood, metal, bone, etc. Of course, singing needs no music accompaniment and is perceived as helping social groups to develop communication and maintain close-knit communities. Since 5000 BC, Egyptian priest physicians were using music for healing purposes, along with tribal shamans, religious orders, and the Greek father of medicine, Hippocrates, credited for the doctor's Hippocratic Oath, was playing music to his patients back in 400 BC. The British Association for Music Therapy believes there are wider healing effects of sound in psychological clinical intervention, assisting those with verbal communication difficulties and improving baby and parent bonding. At the opposite end of the age range, music is helping the elderly cope with dementia and feelings of isolation. Even the trend for sound bathing uses metal gongs, one of the most ancient designed instruments, originating from rock gongs, natural stones which resonate sound when struck. There is one fine example of a shaped edge rock gong found on an archaeological dig in Sudan, Africa, and donated to the British Museum. Social media too has many examples of diverse and experimental rhythmic sound, such as improvising with hitting hollow tubes, known as boom whackers, and substituting drums with pots, dustbins, or oil drums. Woodwind flutes were next on the evolution scale, with hand-carved flutes made of bone or mammoth tusks ivory, discovered on further archaeological digs in Slovenia and Germany, dating to over 35,000 years ago. Interestingly, cave paintings in southwestern France depict a string bow being used by a tribal medicine person, subsequently found to be played by American tribes and current San tribal people of the Kalahari Desert, Africa, who actually convert their hunting longbows for musical use. Later, evidence in the Indian subcontinent produced the multi-stringed instruments of the lyre and the harp, which led eventually to the harpsichord and, of course, the well-known modern piano. In 1971, the BBC TV Christmas show of Morecambe and Wise included a comedy sketch of Grieg's piano concerto with André Previn conducting the orchestra and Eric Morecambe at the soloist's piano making a terrible din, whereby Previn cannot resist pointing out that Eric is playing all the wrong notes, to which he replies to the world-famous conductor, "I'm playing all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order." Although the premise is funny, it does highlight the fact that music can be a very subjective art form and not always rigidly structured. Take, for example, the somewhat random but tuneful style, jazz. However, going back to the basics of vocal arrangements can still encapsulate the essence of harmony. The polyphonic pieces, polyphonic meaning many sounds or voices, mostly began as folk songs and is unique to each region of England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. The oldest known British song is from the mid-13th century, written on a manuscript found in Reading Abbey, Berkshire, titled "Suma is a Cumin Inn," and sung not only in the original Wessex dialect, but in a medieval polyphonic round of six parts. Recorded these days by interpretive musicians, it still retains the sentiment of summer arriving as the cuckoo song. Here, by kind permission of Simon Mair and Hilary James through acousticsrecords.co.uk, is an extract of their own version of "Suma is a Coming In."
Suma is a coming in. Suma is a coming in. Suma is a coming in.
Speaking of records, these are some Guinness World Records relating to British music achievements. In 2014, the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester had the greatest number of people playing a single piano simultaneously, managing to get 16 pianists around the keyboard. Unfortunately, this world record was subsequently broken by a group of Cypriot classical pianists with 25 playing in 2023. On a much grander scale, in 2013, Volcorns were decommissioned across the UK. To mark this historic event, a piece of music was written by Lise Autogina and Joshua Portway with composer Orlando Goff. They gathered three brass bands on the coast, 55 ships on the North Sea, and operated the Salter Lighthouse, Foghorn, for the very last time to perform their Foghorn Requiem live in Sunderland, Northeast England. A musical piece made all the more difficult as it needed the conductor to coordinate bands, computer-controlled GPS to each ship, and factor in sound time delays because they were several miles distance from the lighthouse, while still delivering the best performance for audiences on the clifftops. May you enjoy the beauty and benefits of music, whatever the style.
DNF Soundings.